Hey everybody, welcome to episode 15 of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, leading you down the rabbit hole of a baffling disappearance that occurred on May 14th, 2008. 19-year-old Marshall, Minnesota resident Brandon Swanson, who had just completed a technical program related to wind turbines at a local community college, attended a party with friends the night before graduation. But on his ride home later that evening, he got his car stuck in a ditch on the side of the road. And while he was able to get his father on the phone to come try to assist, the two were ultimately unable to find each other, despite the fact that Brandon repeatedly claimed he knew his location. Yet, Brandon stayed on the phone with the man for longer than 45 minutes, at which point he suddenly exclaimed, "Oh shit." And that's when the call went dead. Brandon Swanson was never seen again, alive or dead. His fate is a mystery. Or is it? You see, as I've mentioned in previous shows, I think cold cases that haven't been solved due to an absence of significant facts, or even a corruption of the facts, deserve to be examined within the context of human nature, rather than rely solely on new leads. Especially in the case of disappearances where it seems nobody had a motive for wanting the victim dead. And that's what this is. Now, there's not a ton of evidence in this one, so this is going to be a little bit of a shorter feature episode. But I really find this case fascinating, and I hope you'll look into it on your own, you know, if you feel the same way. It's a bit of a guessing game. Anyhow, for all intents and purposes, Brandon Swanson was a normal college-age kid going to school, hanging out with his friends, working to make some cash, and just generally figuring out what he wanted to do with his life. There's no hidden stash of cocaine buried in his parents' backyard, or even $100,000 in small bills under his bed. He's just some kid who walked off into the night and never returned. But how? Where? When? There are so many questions in this case, and perhaps their answers are too profound for the likes of my mediocre mind. So I employed the help of legendary playwright Samuel Beckett, of Waiting for Godot fame. Of course, he's dead, but here's a little something he once put to paper. "The end is the beginning, yet you go on." And while this directly applies to the nature of your existence after birth, what it also applies to is this: everything that happens in this world. Yet, just like life, the place where it is most apparent is in retrospect. And so it remains in this story. The end was in the beginning, and I'm going to show you where. This event is drenched in symbolism, its sap dripping from the trees among the forest where we'll be searching. Inside Brandon's head, in his heart, and in his car. That's where all of this starts. So pay close attention to his motivations as we follow the timeline. And notice how, as he becomes frustrated and engages in the disunity between strong desire and poor logic, his fate is already etched in stone. Because the energy that precipitates an event becomes that event, meaning the nature of the disappearance in this case must, by default, mirror that of the events that led to it. This isn't negotiable. It's not a "this host is crazy" moment, even though he is, of course. But for now, I ask you to take your mind out of the courtroom and place it inside Brandon's head. Because our goal here is not to prove, but to see. And once we view the truth, we'll know where to find clues. So, Brandon starts out the evening of Tuesday, May 13th at the house of some friends in Lynde, Minnesota. This is a small gathering of maybe 5 to 10 people, and it's reported that Brandon had at least one beer, but no one has claimed he was intoxicated. Between 10:30 and 11 that evening, Brandon leaves this party and drives to another in Canby, where a classmate lives. Now, here he consumes a shot of whiskey, but again, nobody reports anything beyond that total. So, it can only be confirmed that Brandon Swanson drank one beer and one shot of whiskey that night. And of course, this is a big point of contention, because some of the events to come indicate a lack of physical coordination and a desire to avoid the cops. But I'm here to tell you something. It doesn't matter if he had one shot or 15. The result was going to be the same. Samuel Beckett tells us this. But we'll get to that. Moving on in the timeline, we have Brandon leaving the second location shortly after midnight, his intended destination being his parents' house in Marshall where he lives. And it's here the alcohol consumption question normally comes into play, because Brandon clearly chooses dark, remote back roads over the main highways, and even later admits this to his father on the phone. Now, it's difficult to establish why he decided to take this route. There are two obvious answers, which are closely correlated. One thing that's true without question is that his desire was to avoid the cops. And we might never know if it's because he'd been drinking in excess of what we've been told, or if being underage with alcohol in his breath was enough for him to take this extra precaution. One of these things is true, however. Yet we have to proceed in ignorance. But what we do know is that, at some point, he avoids taking Highway 68 and instead opts for gravel roads northeast of the highway. What he doesn't seem to realize, however, at least to an extent that he fails to make the proper adjustment, is that these roads don't run parallel to the highway and would require a very specific pattern of turns to follow the highway's path. So already Brandon has opted for unfamiliar terrain, navigating it in the blackest darkness, away from the lights of the highway. And this is rural Minnesota. You're lost in the vast timber, a narrow gauntlet of trees leaning over your car with limbs reaching out to grab you, the gravel crunching beneath the tires on a road to nowhere. And he's getting sleepy, frustrated, bored of the radio. And now his head is bobbing. He snaps out of it, rolls down a window, breathes. But he missed his turn. Shit. Or is that the turn? He decides to keep going. Soon, though, it's apparent he's lost. He doesn't know if he should turn around. He yawns, makes a turn simply because it seems like a different direction that offers hope. But this is a lie. He's still lost, and looking at the clock, and ready for bed. By now, it's 1:15 a.m., and he's no closer to finding his way home than he was an hour ago. He decides that he needs to turn around, and turns west onto a maintenance road between two fields of crops in an effort to get back onto another gravel road up ahead going south. And this is when he makes the turn, judges it poorly, and his car gets stuck in a ditch. You see, the road was bordered by shallow, steep channels on either side. So even though this happened at a low speed, and there was also no damage to the car, the vehicle was left in a position where it couldn't be driven. So Brandon tried to contact a few friends with his cell phone at this point, but was unable to reach them. He finally made the dreaded decision to call his parents at 1:54 a.m. and enlist their help. Now, the way this is normally covered is by jumping right into Brandon's call with his father and where that ultimately leads. But the one question I want answered is this. In the time that elapsed between 1:15 a.m. when the accident happened and 1:54 when he called his parents, why didn't he make any attempt to stack objects under his tires in a manner that could potentially free the car from where it was trapped? The answer has to be one of two things. Either he was not in a physical state conducive to completing the task, or he was just a scared kid who needed help out of a situation he wasn't prepared to deal with. Either way, this is where we arrive at the writing on the wall. Brandon Swanson was not equipped to handle this situation. And that's why he did nothing but seek the help of others after his own mistakes left him stranded on the side of the road. Once his father receives the call and says he's coming, Brandon basically has two choices. Wait for as long as it takes for help to finally arrive, or continue to engage the disunity between strong desire and poor logic, which ends only one way when continuously applied to your behavior. And that's death. And that's what Brandon chose. In ignorance, of course. But he died the moment he walked away. And here's where we get to that quote. The end is in the beginning, but still you go on. And that's what Brandon did. Into the darkness. Alone. Under the guise that the lights up ahead would lead him home. And in the most tragic sense, they did. You see, if Brandon was in a state while driving where he was prone to making wrong turns and dropping into ditches where he couldn't manage to escape, the same thing was going to happen when he proceeded on foot. The nature of the consequences of his actions has already been established. He's basically sticking his hand in the lion's mouth to see if it will bite. And you can be sure it's going to. The universe has to react that way. Because Brandon's inevitable disappearance was nothing more than a mathematical probability that came to fruition. And the resounding effects of this tragedy take hold immediately. What follows is a series of calls between Brandon and his parents where he claims to be in one location, but when the couple gets near, there's no sight of him. Now, Brandon's father claims the young man didn't sound intoxicated, specifically stating Brandon wasn't slurring his words. However, it's apparent that his inability to disclose his location with any manner of accuracy, despite repeated attempts, indicates he was disoriented to an extent his sense of direction was inhibited. And so was his judgment. Because this is where frustration finally causes him to tell his mother, at 2:17 a.m., that he's going to venture on foot to the town of Lind, where a friend lives. He believes he sees the light of the town up ahead. At this point, the Swansons have already gone to the location Brandon described, but despite both parties flashing their high beams back and forth, they couldn't detect one another. In fact, they later learned they were miles apart. Brandon, who was convinced he was near the town of Lind, was actually 20 miles to the south. So why did he believe he was elsewhere? It seems incredibly strange. I could only venture to guess the length of his drive and confusion about his direction from making so many turns on unfamiliar roads brought him to this conclusion. Either way, Brandon's mom is getting tired by this point, and his dad is going to drop her off before coming back to find Brandon. And that's when the call takes place where Brandon and his father are on the line for more than 45 minutes. Unable to connect to Brandon's car, he says he's going to walk into Lind and asks his father to then meet him there, outside a tavern. But the town Brandon sees is actually Porter. So he sends his father to a place where he's not going to be, and he abandons his car not realizing he actually has no idea where it really is. I mean, I have no doubt everyone thinks I'm crazy for believing he's already dead at this point, but consider this for a second. Brandon has initiated a series of events that are conducive to the same repeated behavior born of false logic, in much the same way as an addiction. Regardless of the root cause, he's not in a position to get himself out of this mess. He's only programmed to make it worse. But the real tragedy is that his logic stems from his staunch beliefs, so he's unable to act in any other way at this point except the one that's going to get him killed. And that's the key in this mystery. Somebody had to stop him. It didn't happen. So, what naturally occurred next is exactly what occurred prior. Brandon's location becomes more and more of a mystery, increasingly so as the searches continue and the years pass. This is because of parallels, which I've mentioned previously, of course. Pay very close attention to parallels, especially in disappearances and cold cases, as they reveal undeniable patterns in behavior. With that, it stands to reason there isn't any reason to believe we would ever find Brandon's body. He was repetitiously engaging choices utilizing strong desire and poor logic, which is the foundation of ignorance. Therefore, how are we left? Ignorant. So, the discussion about Brandon Swanson's disappearance really shouldn't be based upon the notion of what happened to him. Because when we examine the events that precipitated his vanishing, we see that he brought it all upon himself through his own actions. Now, I'm certainly not pointing blame in his direction. What I'm doing is suggesting that the answer to this riddle, which is simply finding Brandon's body, is not walking around looking at the ground with a pack of German shepherds. To the contrary, the solution, despite its difficulty, is to replicate the nature of the young man's logic in order to more closely analyze what choices he would have made and how he ended up. So, think about those flashing headlights in the darkness for a moment. The ones coming from Brandon's car in some place he's sure he can identify, but really can't. And then consider his parents flashing the headlights back at him, following his instructions to the letter, but continuing to get farther and farther away. In this case, there was a physical manifestation of his abnormal logic that created a purgatory in which he existed prior to his death. And guess what? His mother senses it. She lets go. She goes home. Intuitively, she knows what's happening, even if it's all still being presented to her as just being tired and getting dropped off so Brandon's dad can go back and get him. I have no doubt there was a looming presence in that car on the ride back. The burden of fate weighing upon them even before the culmination of the tragedy. But Brandon's father still has a connection to his son through his phone. He isn't giving up quite yet. So he jumps on the line with Brandon for that 45-minute plus phone call where the two of them try to coordinate locations. Of course, it doesn't work, and the call is cut off when Brandon says, "Oh shit." That's the last contact they ever have. Now, it would be highly beneficial to know the manner in which Brandon said these words, as it could provide enormous context. For instance, if the words were born of awe, meaning he saw something that stopped him in his tracks, there could perhaps be a measure of discernible fear in his voice. Yet, if he slipped and fell, the words would have a tendency to mimic the abrupt nature of the incident. But in the end, we really don't need to know that to make a determination. We just go back and examine the car accident. So what happened? Here's the summary. The car fell into a ditch when Brandon misjudged a turn in the darkness of an unknown place while trying to find his way. It became disabled. Brandon was not able to get it out of the hole. He called for help, but it didn't arrive because he was unable to convey his location because of his physical and/or emotional state. Now, this is exactly what would happen to a person if you fell into a hole. Yet there's suspicion of foul play because nobody ever found a body, or even smelled one. But then think about the parallels again. Compare the smell of the body to the flashing of the high beams. Sure, undoubtedly both things occurred, but neither was noticed by anyone. And that's because, in both cases, the location is vastly inaccurate due to the logic being applied. Now, Brandon could have succumbed to a number of unfortunate occurrences, including falling into a well or some sort of cavern, or even a nearby Yellow Medicine River, which had high water levels at the time from post-winter snowmelt. Supposedly, its depth would have gone down to about 15 feet, with a swiftly moving current. One would think, however, that the body, or even parts of his clothing, would wash ashore at some point. Yet, nearly a decade later, there's no sign of him, which I think speaks volumes to the theory that he fell into something and was never found. But what we can say for sure is this. After the oh shit moment, something prevented him from continuing to use his phone. Whether he lost it, became incapacitated, or even both. But if you just took a misstep that landed your car in a ditch in a dark, unfamiliar place, and nobody intervenes to change your fate as you move forward under the same faulty logic, you're fucking dead. There's not a nicer way to say it. It's that simple. This is the overdose where the family claims it wasn't a suicide. But when you behave in ignorance of the fact your actions are going to precipitate death, you're killing yourself in the absence of a definitive choice, but in the comfort of a logic that suggests everything's going to be okay if you just keep doing more of what you've been doing. Which is what Brandon Swanson did. Which is also what drug addicts do. And so do the rest of us. Every day, while making false promises to ourselves that we'll change. But when we don't follow through, we suffer the consequences. And that is, very simply, what happened to Brandon Swanson. He couldn't stop. And in that light, we should consider that maybe our fascination with this case is based upon the fact that the way we've been investigating the conclusion parallels the manner in which Brandon attempted to find his way home. But the problem with that is that parallels don't intersect. We need to connect the adapter to port and find the situation that will conduct enough electricity to enlighten us with the truth. That's the map somebody should be making. One of Brandon's mind. Of his compulsion. Of his pain. We need a map of his decisions, rather than Minnesota. Because Brandon Swanson made a wrong turn on foot in the darkness and was disabled when he landed in a hole. And when nobody heard his cries for help, he ultimately died. It was predetermined. It was fate. It was one of those moments where we understand that humanity's free will is imprisoned in a facility with the highest walls and the greatest of security. And it's one you can never escape. But the real draw to his story is this. It parallels every mistake humans make in life that can't be reconciled. The ones that clench our hearts like a fist when we look back and realize ourselves as being a freight train out of control in a situation where we thought we knew it all. These are the things we smile through in retrospect, that haunt us at the breakfast table over coffee. The ones where you have to feign happiness when the new person you love is across the table wondering. This is the death of a smile. It's the past, the undeniable anchor of constant burden that's tied to our existence forever. And I think that reveals a single glimmer of hope lingering among the vast cloud of fear that consumes our thoughts. One word that makes this disappearance magnetic in a way that we absolutely need to know the truth. And that word is freedom. Our greatest fear, death, is our freedom from the looming shadow of the past. And the greatest tragedy of all is that we must run toward it while simultaneously running away. Yet when we examine that logic, one thing becomes apparent. We are all Brandon Swanson. And for each of us, the night where we make a wrong turn and break down on the side of the road will come. Our cries for help will go unheard. And the flashes of light as we fade into the darkness will remain unseen. Yet, as we look around us in those last moments, wondering what lies beyond, a smile will cross our lips. Because the transcendence from life to death emotionally alters the one concept that prevents you from happiness. And that's the moment when the unknown is no longer symbolic of fear, but the greatest of freedom. And as we continue the fruitless search for Brandon Swanson, with the chains of humanity dragging behind us with every step, please remind yourself to never look back at the sound. Because everything you're searching for, all that is good in this world, lies ahead. And the evidence shows that, if there's anything within Brandon's logic from that night that we can admire, that actually makes sense to the point we can follow the trail to locate the truth, to find him waiting for us at the end, it's the perseverance to always keep moving. Because at the core of the human spirit, is exactly what Samuel Beckett wrote. The end is in the beginning, yet you go on.